Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the ALPLM. And now here are your hosts, Dr. Jacob Freefeld and Corinne Claycomb.
Hello and welcome to the State of Sound podcast. My name is Corinne Claycomb with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and on today's episode, exhibit director Lance Tauzer, the designer of the exhibit, he sat down with Tim McElrath from Rise Against, a very popular punk band originated in the suburbs of Chicago, and they were able to talk about the punk scene and the right place, right time kind of situation being in Chicago in the 90s with those excellent punk bands, Smoking Popes, Naked Ray Gun, all those other cool ones. So let's talk a little bit more about punk.
And I'm Jake Freefeld. I'm the ALPLM's Midwest and Illinois historian. And I like that you mentioned this was the 90s revival of punk, but punk does have this long history back into the 70s. It's a critique of pop music at the time, but also is sort of this political statement against Cold War political culture. Think Vietnam War, think Watergate. But yes, McElrath is part of this 90s revival. And even though I like the history of punk, as a historian, I also enjoy the fact that I have this personal connection with McElrath's story that he talks about in his interview, that he grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and he used transportation to get involved in the punk scene. And I remember how important trains were growing up on the south side or the southwest suburbs, getting to the city, not into the punk scene, but my nerdy friends and I more so into museums. But I really enjoyed that personal connection I had with McElrath's story.
Yeah, and I had my personal connections as well in that I kind of grew up in a punk scene, so to speak, and I was not, of course, up there at the front of the shows getting, you know, moshed around or anything like that. If I'm at the show, I'm closer towards the back, just kind of enjoying the music and enjoying the atmosphere. But there is a punk scene here in my hometown of Springfield as well. And it's always been about word of mouth, even though now today we can have, you know, social media to help promote bands and to promote shows and promote different little local record stores and everything. There is still a heavy reliance on those little 4x5 pieces of paper on the counter at the record store or the skate shop that promotes the shows and that, you know, you just have to be there kind of thing. So for McElrath, a big part of his story is just trying to get to where the action is. And, you know, eventually he, you know, gets a little bigger and he talked about his Warped Tour experience. And that's another connection that I had in that that was probably the biggest punk show that I had been to. I had been to a lot of little tiny local punk shows here in Springfield, you know, Black Sheep Cafe, Bar None, the different places around town, some all ages venues as well, which he talked about quite a bit and promoted those. They're great. He talked about the Warped Tour and that being a really cool experience and kind of sensory overload because you're surrounded by so many different bands. And I was actually there at one of the Warped Tours that he had talked about being in 2008, 2009, I think, and getting to see those big bands and, you know, being able to pay tribute. And that's what he was able to do with covering that Minor Threat song. He was able to kind of pay homage to the bands that inspired him when he was growing up. And so he actually paid that tribute on his guitar during that tour. He put stickers on the back of that Les Paul guitar that was given to him. And some people, you know, shriek, "Oh my God, what are you doing to that guitar?" And he's like, "No, it's a guitar. It's meant to be played. It's going to get busted up. It's fine." So that was his little tribute to Minor Threat.
That's awesome that you were at that Warped Tour. It'd be cooler if you would have seen Rise Against play. So could you alter the story a bit for us?
Sure, yeah. In addition to, you know, Bad Religion, NoFX, Bouncing Souls, and a little bit of Jimmy Eat World, Rise Against was there, and yeah, it was great.
Wonderful. And the other thing is, I'm also not into the punk scene myself. You'd be surprised, right? Because you think history conference, there's a lot of moshing that goes on at history conferences.
Oh, I think some of the biggest punks I know are historians.
Yeah, during my talks, I get, the response I get.
Yes.
But what I loved about McElrath's story the most is seeing him grow as an artist from this 90s punk scene and then grow as a lyricist, too, later in his career. But right now, you don't want to hear from us. You want to hear from McElrath himself, so we're going to get you to our interview with our exhibits director, Lance Tauzer, and Tim McElrath of Rise Against. But stay tuned after the interview for follow-up reactions from Corinne, Lance, and myself.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm today's interviewer, Lance Tauzer. I'm also the curator of the State of Sound exhibit here at ALPLM. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of speaking to Tim McElrath, the singer and guitarist of the band Rise Against. We're recording this in the State of Sound studios. So I know you've been asked 1,000 times about the origin of the band. I'm particularly interested because the whole point of this exhibit is to celebrate the music that comes from the state. And so I'm really kind of interested in hearing sort of, the band's origin story with regards to, you know, its connection to Illinois in Chicago and the burbs.
I'd say that Joe and I are from the Chicago area. He grew up in Downers Grove. I grew up in Arlington Heights, and he's about four or five years older than I am. But we both played in bands throughout the Chicagoland area throughout our adolescence. So like playing music and playing shows around Chicago became like a really important thing to us in our teen years. And so we were very much part of this like Chicago punk rock scene, which was like super influential. It was probably starting with bands like Naked Ray Gun, going on to bands like Pegboy or the Blue Meanies or Alkaline Trio, or you know, there was so much amazing stuff happening in Chicago. This is, I'm talking about probably like early 90s, like mid 90s, all through the 90s. And then so Joe and I were part of that punk rock scene, and we met each other through there. And so by the time we got to I was college aged, and so was Joe. We decided our bands that we had been a part of, were no longer. And so we decided to hook up and start a new project. And that turned out to be, Rise Against.
Yeah. So, growing up in the burbs of, what was sort of the feeding? You talked a little bit about the punk scene. What was your go-to music store, or who did you take lessons from? What was the scene like, if you would?
Yeah. Oh man. Like, back then, so that was like early 90s out here. We had Record Breakers and Hoffman Estates, and we had Rose Records in Arlington Heights. So I remember riding my bike there and buying records. But what's great about Chicago and the outlying suburbs is that we're very well connected through trains. And so even before I had my driver's license, my friends and I were able to hop on the Metra and get into the city itself. That's where everything was happening, right? That's where the shows were happening. That's where the cool record stores were. That's where like Reckless was, or Dummy Room, or, you know, all the like, just the great places to kind of like look for, like all the skate shops were there. And so that was a huge part of growing up, was like, you know, just kind of like getting out of school and then hopping on that train and then just like skating around Chicago and finding all the cool shops and to go to, and then eventually ending up at a show usually, you know, and seeing the bands and sort of chasing bands around Chicago. This is obviously like a pre-internet era, so it was all a lot of word of mouth, you know, word of mouth. And then those stores became like record stores, like Reckless became important because that's where you'd find a flyer or a poster for the show. That's how you found out about it, because the internet wasn't really a thing quite yet. So that network was super important. Finding out about a show was kind of like finding out about like a party, you know, you kind of had to be in the know to do it. And that's kind of like what we were doing. And it was a really cool and amazing scene to grow up in, because like, I was going to see shows at Metro, like you said, or like, but I've also seen shows all over the Chicagoland area, like the Elmhurst VFW Hall was having shows back then, the Third Floor and Elgin. We had the Arlington Heights Knights of Columbus here in my town. And so it was like, I had really cool bands that were playing shows like really close to me. And so we just bounced around, you know, hitching rides and taking trains. And sometimes the show was at a squat. You know, sometimes the show was like an abandoned building or like somebody's basement. Like you kind of never knew what you were going to walk into. Like, especially the scene was far, like, was more informal back then. Like there were a lot of bands that, you know, weren't big enough for like a metro type place, but they still wanted to play like all these shows. And so those shows happened in a lot of like informal settings. But it was a lot of fun. You know, it was just like, I chased Los Crudos around. I chased a band called Psyche Kato around. You know, this was like the time of like No Empathy, the Meshuggahs, the Blue Meanies, Smoking Popes, Slapstick was playing a lot. Man, 8 Bark, like there were just so many cool Chicago bands, not to mention all the touring acts that were coming through.
That's exactly what I was looking for with regards to the story and your connection, that sort of rite of passage of taking the train in from the suburbs, hitting the record store, finding out about a gig, and then, you know, sort of having your entire evening or weekend be shaped by what you find out when you get there. That's kind of unique, and especially all ages shows were particularly important to punk bands as well, wouldn't you say?
Yes, they were so important because, you know, you're getting into music at a young age. You don't want to wait till you're 21 to go see a live show. Like the most formative years of music for me were between the ages of like 14 and 21, you know, and had I had to wait, honestly, it would have been so different for me because those were such important years. And so, yeah, so these all ages shows were super important to me and my friends. And then they really are like a lot of the reason why I'm here today, you know. And so to this day, Rise Against plays almost exclusively all ages shows. I mean, if we're not playing on all ages shows, it's because there's some sort of citywide ordinance, you know, that prevents us from doing it. But it is always our preference to play an all ages show.
Yeah, well, there's that famous story about Dave Grohl at age 13 getting into the Cubby Bear to see Naked Ray Gun and changing his life.
Totally, yeah. I can remember, like, what was it? I remember my buddy Neil, who plays drums in the Lawrence Arms. He was a huge Melvins fan. Mm. And Melvins were playing, I don't know what club they were playing now, I can't think of it, but it was 21 and over. And Neil was probably 17, you know. And he bought a ticket. And I was like, Neil, what are you doing? You can't get in. He goes, I know, but I can't imagine not being there when the Melvins come to town and like play a show. I got to go. I got to do something. And I was like, all right. And so he takes his ticket and he goes down there. And of course he gets to know, you know, from the club, and he gets to know from everybody around. They're like, dude, no, what are you doing? You can't get in. And he just hangs out by the backstage door room, like for a long time. And actually, King Buzzo came out at some point, and cause he heard this kid was back there and talked to him. And like, it was super cool to him, like hung out with him for a minute. And, you know, and then told him like, yo, like, I can't get you in, just so you know, it's like a huge, like, it's a huge liability. If I do that, I'll get in a lot of trouble, but yeah. Thanks for coming out on the show. But that's how important going to a show was, even if like, you know, you were underage. You know, I remember doing a similar thing to like an acoustic artist. I was trying to get in a double door and like, I couldn't get in, but I remember meeting him outside of the show, you know. Those age restrictions were like annoying. You know, there are things that you kind of had to like dodge, you know.
I was going to ask you a question about your songwriting, specifically the lyrics. You're well known for writing songs that have purpose or expressing a point. When did you first feel compelled to sort of express your views in music? Was it, you know, from the beginning, or was it something that you grew into?
I think it's something that I grew into. I never really planned on being like a front man or, you know, like the writer of lyrics, that kind of thing. I knew I wanted to play music, but I always kind of figured it would be behind somebody else. You know, I always figured it would be like, I'd be the guitar player, or the bass player of like a band, and somebody else would be in charge of doing all that sort of stuff that I do now. But I think I just kind of fell backwards into that because I never found that person. You know, I never found that singer of a band. I never found that lyricist. I never found someone to kind of stand behind while they sort of fronted the band. And so I sort of just started doing it myself. And throughout my adolescence, I played in a band called Baxter with my friends and with Neil, actually, from Lawrence Arms. He was the guitar player. And I was writing lyrics, but they were kind of an afterthought. You know, they were like, the music is what I was focused on. Lyrics were something that had to be done to like complete the song. But they were, I don't know how to describe them. They were just more like a stream of consciousness kind of stuff. So there was not a lot like to really latch on to. And so by the time Rise Against rolled around and I was going to, you know, be the front man of this band, I was taking it a lot more seriously. I was thinking, you know, I was kind of like, I didn't like the fact that I couldn't look back on Baxter songs and be like, well, this song was about this. You know what I mean? Or this song was about this, or like people knew what they were about. And so I made a more concentrated effort to create songs that were less cryptic and more like about things, you know? And that was, I guess, it was a pretty conscious decision to do that. And then I was glad that I did it. It was like, it's harder to do, but it paid off in the end because it gave life to all these songs. Like it gave identity to all these songs. And then that's kind of when I guess I became like a real lyricist, like a real writer, you know, and all the reading and the English classes I've been doing, you know, were starting to pay off. It was like, okay, I know a little bit about prose and I can kind of put this together. But it was, I never saw it happening and until it really just happened. And then when people really connected with it, you know, then I was like, oh, like these lyrics are far more than just an afterthought. And in some ways they are the engine of the songs.
Yeah. People seem to respond more to what you're saying in a song than a really clever guitar riff or something along those lines.
Yes. Those are the things I was learning as a young man.
All right. So here's a question for you. Have Blackhawks fans ever forgiven you for the Corey Crawford injury at one of your concerts?
Oh man. You bring up such a sensitive subject. I'm surprised. You know, here's the deal. The answer is yes. Blackhawks fans have forgiven, and Corey's forgiven me personally. But the Hawks won that year. Like, they won the Stanley Cup.
Oh.
And so what happens when teams win is nobody goes back over the season to critique it. You know what I mean? So that whole year, I had my fingers crossed that the Hawks would do well, and thank God they did. Because if the Hawks did not win, I guarantee we'd be having a lot more Corey Crawford conversations and blaming Rise Against for it. thank God they won, you know, and that worked out. And I'll tell you what else too. For Hawks fans know that after Crawford was out, that was when they put Scott Darling in.
Right.
And his
hometown guy.
Yeah. So people really rallied around Darling because he's a hometown guy. Everyone liked him and he did really well. And it was his first real meaningful playing with the Hawks, you know, which gave him like, I think another year at the Hawks. And then he signed a pretty lucrative deal, somewhere else, you know? And so I went to a Cubs game. Oh, the Cubs Sox game at Wrigley. Mm. And I sit down at my seat. This is a couple of years ago now. And I sit down next to this big bearded guy and I look over and I'm like, wait, you look familiar. He's like, yeah, you look familiar. I'm like, you're Scott Darling. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, I'm Tim from Rise Against. He goes, holy shit. You know? And it was, we started to put all the pieces together and he's like, basically you're the reason that I'm a professional hockey player in some ways.
Did he buy like a beer? You don't drink beer.
Yeah. And I don't. Yeah. But yeah, he wanted to he turned to his wife. He's like, hey, this guy pretty much bought our house, just so you know.
Oh, I love that.
It was really funny.
He always looked like he could be in a band too, Scott Darling.
You know, he's a huge music head. Like, he loves music and rock and metal. We were talking about a band while we were there, actually. And so he's way into music. You're right. He struck me as kind of like a guy, I'd be on tour with.
Your
You're listening to the State of Sound podcast. I'm Lance Tauzer, the curator of the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois. And today I'm talking to Tim McElrath, the lead singer and guitarist of the Chicago band Rise Against. So you have loaned us this wonderful guitar for this exhibit. It's a white Gibson Les Paul, and it's got these lettering on the back that there's several pictures of you sort of holding it up upside, and it's not upside down when you hold it up over your head, and it says out of step. You want to tell us a little bit about the guitar and the meaning of the graphic on it?
Yeah, so that was probably the first guitar I ever got like for free, like from Gibson, which was really cool. Like our band, this was probably during, I guess it was during Suffer and the Witness years of Rise Against, which is like 2000, their fourth album. So it's like 2008 maybe. And we were playing Gibsons all the time. And then Gibson was like, let us know if you want us to help you out. And we're like, well, yeah, of course, that'd be amazing. And so they gave me that guitar, and they gave our other guitar player like a black version of that. And then I just took that thing on tour and just like beat the crap out of it, like having a blast playing this amazing instrument. And I remember being on Warped Tour and sitting on the bus with it and just playing it around and just really feeling like, Warped Tour was such a cool vibe, and like so many people every day, and just you're interacting with all of these kids, and you're kind of, you're introducing them to your band, and they're curious about the bands that influenced you. And we were doing like a Minor Threat cover around that time. And so Minor Threat has a song called Out of Step, and Minor Threat was an important band to me, still is. And for like those listening who don't know, it's like a DC punk band fronted by Ian MacKay, who later went to do Fugazi, and really one of the first like hardcore punk bands. You know, there was punk rock, which was like Clash, Pistols, you know, that kind of stuff. But hardcore punk, like Minor Threat, was one of the pioneers of, and it was one of the first bands I really identified with. Like, I loved all things punk, but I was never like going to be like a New York Dolls guy. You know what I mean? I was going to be like a Minor Threat guy. This sort of this message, you know, I was straight edge, still am. And so like all that stuff was really hitting me hard, and it still played a huge role in just like my own songwriting. And so I remember Warped Tour is crazy because you don't see like civilization, you know, like you see like thousands of people every day, but you drive overnight. You don't stay in hotels. You sleep on the bus, and then like you're in a field in like Missouri for like 8 hours, and then you're back in the bus, and then you're in a field in Nebraska for 8 hours.
Right.
And so the only time you interact with civilization, is if you stop at a truck stop at 3 a.m. and that's kind of, it becomes the place where like, if you wanted candy or if you wanted something the Warped Tour doesn't provide, this is your interaction with civilization. I remember being there and just stocking up on whatever junk a 27-year-old eats at that point in my life. And then, buying those huge letters, like just kind of like from their like section of just like signs and whatnot, you know, and I'm like, I'm going to put this on the back of my guitar. And I took the letters back to the bus, grabbed my guitar, and I was like, I spelled out of step on the back of the guitar. And I was like, this was like my tribute to Minor Threat. This is my tribute to like one of my biggest influences. And then also my way to communicate my influences to our audience. And then it became a guitar that I was playing for a long time, so people became familiar with it.
So these are truck stop letters on the back.
They literally are trucks. Yeah, they're not like hand painted by the top guitar design. They literally are just like stickers from a truck stop on a Warped Tour by 2008. I can still remember doing everyone looking like, what are you doing to that guitar? You're going to ruin it. And I'm like, no, I've already ruined this guitar. I'm going to keep ruining it. Like we're going to make it cool now.
Well, that's awesome. That's very punk rock, of course. You know, you don't want to have to hand paint it, you know.
It's kind of true, yeah. It's kind of, I look at all my instruments, too. Like, I see them as tools, not as, like, collector's items. You know, they're things that should be played and loved and used and not just, like, you know, hung up on a wall never to be touched. You know what I mean? Like, you want to, I don't know. That's, at least that's my attitude towards it.
So you feel this guitar served you well for a long time is what you're saying?
Absolutely. I toured all of Suffer and the Witness and probably the record after that as well. Wrote a lot of songs on it.
That's awesome.
And then I cracked the headstock off one.
You said that when I picked it up.
Yeah. So people can maybe able to see the repair job on there from all the cracks. So Les Paul's headstocks crack off.
Yeah.
It happens. But they are repairable. Mm. And some people will swear that the instrument sounds better and is more solid with a repaired headstock than the standard headstock. So I don't know. That could just be wishful thinking. I haven't noticed a ton of difference, but it at least didn't change for me. Like I didn't make it like a, it didn't make a less desirable instrument. So
I was going to say, you probably don't want to encourage the kids to break their Les Pauls.
Yeah. Don't break your Les Pauls. Like it's still not, cause some repairs are fixable and some are not fixable. So it just depends on the way it cracks. I've had a headstock crack on an acoustic before that's been fixed and it's fine. Then I had the headstock crack on that. I don't remember doing it. I'll be honest. Like I remember playing the guitar, just like finishing the show and leaving it out on the stage. And then my tech came at me like later on that night. He was like, "Hey, did something happen out there?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Like, what, your guitar?" And I was like, "No, fine." And I'm like, he's like, "When I got to your guitar, just so you know, the headstock was cracked off." Wow. And I was like, "Oh shit!" So I must have done something at the end of the show, but I've never been a particularly responsible guitar owner, so it's not a surprise.
Well, like you said, it's sort of a tool of the trade. It's not furniture. It's not
I think that's so true. Yeah, that's how I've always looked. Like I do interviews with like guitar magazines. They want to talk about like collectors' guitars and all these things. Like I've never. It's almost like offensive to me to look at guitars that way. You know what I mean? So like be on like on some rich guy's wall.
Right.
Like they should be in the hands of like a 15-year-old kid, you know, like creating the next era of like rock and punk or whatever he or she is going to do with it. You know, that's what a guitar should be doing, right? Because it's this amazing tool that awesome and incredible things can pour out of. And so that's what it should be. It shouldn't be like this thing where it's like you got to, make sure you don't get your fingerprints on it or keep it behind glass or whatever else. And then how cool, because one day maybe it'll be like in a museum, like your museum, you know, and then people can see it. And because I know that I think of how I felt when I saw like Joe Strummer's guitar in like the Rock Hall of Fame. Like,
yeah.
Which, by the way, looks like it was pulled out of a shipwreck. You know what I mean? Like, it's like just, you get the crap out of thing, like all the cool stickers. I want to know about all of them. I want to know why the sticker is here, you know, all this stuff. Like those stories are cool. And that's, you know, instruments are just kind of these conduits that we flow through.
Well, Joe's guitar has actually been on tour. I know the people at the Rock Hall. They've loaned us a couple of pieces for this show. And there's a contract with the Rock Hall that says that they're not allowed to do anything to that guitar. If it starts to break, if the strings make the neck twist or something, they're not allowed to do anything to it. And it drives the conservators crazy. But that was Joe's wishes. That's his widow's wishes. And that's the way it goes. So... And
that's really cool.
Yeah. And that's part of what we're looking for with this exhibit. We want people to sort of stand in the presence of your guitar. We want them to stand in the presence of Miles Davis's trumpet. We want them to stand in the presence of a Grammy that, Chaka Khan won or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And realize that the connections to these artists have a connection to them, especially if they're from Illinois. And we want people to realize that, the music that came from this state has offered the world, you know, a wide variety of amazing, amazing music. And that was one of the questions I had for you. Looking at your website, looking at your previous tour itineraries, you have been everywhere. Your music has touched people. And I mean, I think your website has like four different languages and international sites. So you are definitely an international artist. What does that kind of feel like? You're a kid from Chicago suburbs and you're in Belgium and you know, the music that you created in your cool studio in Arlington Heights is has an effect on the people of Belgium or wherever else.
Yeah, that stuff is so, like, overwhelming to, like, even, it's hard to grasp, really, you know, because, yeah, we are just these punk rock kids from Chicago who started this band and we didn't even do it in a very careerist way. You know, we did it very much just like, we just want to play these shows with our friends and we put a record out and hopefully go on tour and hopefully do a tour. But the idea that we'd be doing this 20 years later at the level we'd do that is just, it's mind blowing. But it's always fun to represent Chicago and represent Illinois. To be that representative, you know, often Chicago, like we go out to a festival and there's a lot of bands from LA and there's a lot of bands from New York, you know what I mean? But Chicago and Illinois are not always represented, you know? So it's like, we stand out in that way, you know? And it's always been like a source of pride for us to be from this city and to be products of this city's music scene. And then to take those influences with us, like, around the planet. And yeah, like, we're a really international band. We have been since we first started touring. In some ways, the rest of the world even grabbed onto this band before the States even did. Like, Canada was like, well, first place to really adopt what we were doing. The States came around, and then, you know, Germany has been a place where we do a significant amount of what we do, you know, like we do it over there in Germany. And so it's also made me look at our fans as not just like American, you know what I mean? Cause I know they're not, you know, I know that we are a global band, but we have an international community of fans.
Right.
It makes you feel a little bit more connected to the world. It's humbling, you know, to travel, you know, and I had never been to Europe, you know, prior to Rise Against first tour. I never really lived out of the country prior to Rise Against first tour. And so all that stuff is just like really humbling and amazing. And I don't know. It just really makes you, it gives you a lot of perspective.
Yeah. I was just
to be able
that.
To, yeah, it's just like to see how we are all experiencing this planet in very similar ways. And the borders and the languages we speak, like they really are, you know, just kind of these fictions. You know, and then because in the end, we're just kind of a lot of the same people who want the same things. And so I've been really grateful for that sort of international community of Rise Against fans.
That's awesome. You also realize how the rest of the world speaks like 9 languages and people from America just can't seem to figure it out.
It's so true. Like speaking English has made us so lazy because we can go anywhere in the world and get by, where most people from other countries cannot say that. They would need to have some grasp of the English language to get around. Yeah. So yeah, it makes you realize how lucky we are to be able to do that.
So just a couple of quick questions before I let you go. I don't want to let it go before we hang up. I remember pulling up to your building when I was picking up the guitar from you, and you had told me the story about your space. And it was also the thing that really struck me was once you enter your cool studio space, it actually looks a lot bigger on the inside than it seems the building is on the outside. But I'd love for you to tell me the story of the building where you create your music and its history.
Oh yeah. So I have a studio here in Chicago, and it's just sort of, it's like, I think it was like an old dentist laboratory,
right.
I want to say.
Yeah.
And it's just one of these buildings that's been there for a long time, and it's pretty nondescript and anonymous, and it was just a nice place for me to kind of get out and like make music. And like, it's funny. It's one of those things when I finally did it, which was several years ago, I was thinking, why didn't I do this a long time ago?
Right.
I think to do music is such like what a bizarre job I have, you know, like what a crazy, how audacious is it of someone to just call themselves a musician and that's what they do with their time. And I've always sort of been like, on that tip where it's like, I don't think I've ever fully admitted to myself that this is what I do. You know, it took me a lot of years to realize like, oh, this is going to stick. Like, this isn't just like this thing that you do before you go back to college and get a degree and like, and then like figure out something else to do with your life. You know, that's what I assumed it would be, you know, cause it's so kind of, you know, it's crazy and bold to think that you'll still be doing this when you're 40. And so Destiny was part of my commitment to like my career. It was like, oh yeah, all right, I guess this is what I do. Right. You know, there's like, it's not going to, no one's going to pull the plug on it tomorrow. And even if they did, I have 20 years of doing it behind me. Right. You know, like you did it.
Yeah.
And so I love having a space. I've always been jealous of musicians that have like spaces like that where you can kind of like, I've always loved walking into studios. They're always like so inspiring to walk into.
Yeah.
And they give you this feeling like you just want to create, you want to make something. And I was like, but we only make a record every couple of years, right? And so I was only getting that feeling, you know, every couple of years. And so I'm like, I want to feel this like every day. Like I want to walk into a place and pull a guitar off the wall and just start playing loud. And so it was I recommend it. It's a good time.
That's awesome. And actually you walked right into my next question was, so you've got a new record coming out in June. And this is the follow-up to 2017's Wolves record, which, like you said, you only put out a record every 2 years or even 3 years. So what is it? Right. What is it about that pace? What is it about that process where we're sort of in this era where artists are putting out double albums, you know, every other week and, you know, seemingly anyway. what is it about this methodical approach that you guys have taken that is different?
I guess it's sort of like just the approach that the bands that we grew up on were doing, you know what I mean? So it's sort of the pace at which we always saw ourselves doing it. There's no master plan. It's mostly just like us writing a bunch of songs that like we feel like define us at that moment. And then spending a lot of time documenting it, you know, as accurately as possible, and then releasing that record and then hopping in the bus and just like, you know, going on tour and like taking those songs around the world. And those tours, like a tour and album for us is always, it's always been about an 18 month, you know, if not like 2 year process of just like playing shows pretty nonstop, you know? Yeah. And then we get off the road from touring that album, we would start thinking about the next album. And so, and that's kind of been my life for about 9 albums now, you know? So we've just, and we, yeah, and they've come out at different increments. None of those are ever planned. You know what I mean? They're just kind of like, sometimes our touring goes longer, because we have more opportunities sometimes that we just, you know, people are still liking the record and they're still listening to it. And then there's still places we want to go to, or sometimes we get like an offer to open up for like the Foo Fighters in Australia, and now next thing you know, like our tour campaign goes even longer. And so that's just always been, I guess, like our cycle. This cycle has been a little different. You know, we were hoping to have a record out last year,
right?
But obviously everything got thrown in the blender. So here we are. But yeah, on June 4th, we'll put out an album called Nowhere Generation that we are chomping at the bit to get it out there. And, we're super excited to, you know, share some new Rise Against music with the world. I'm super excited for the lights to come back on and actually play this stuff live for people.
Oh, I bet. The single's great. I love the video.
Thank you.
All the ants and everything crawling around. I noticed that this album is available on cassette. Is that something you guys regularly do? Is that a medium that's coming back?
You know, I would have not bet on the cassette to come back. And every time like I talk to like our manager or like the label and they're like, we're going to make cassettes. I'm like, are you sure that's a good idea? And then each time I'm wrong, and cause people buy them. So I'm just as surprised as a lot of people to see the cassette coming back. But I also know that like, I know that fans still want something, even though we live in a time where like having, like you can listen to the music now on your phone, anywhere you are.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the fan is not still wanting to be a part of the experience somehow, or it doesn't mean that they don't have like the resources to like do that. Like they could buy a cassette, cause you know, like we're talking about, you know, 16-year-olds walking around with $800 phones. Right. You know what I mean? Like,
that's right.
You know, they're listening to them on $100 headphones, you know, like all these things. Like I think when I was 16, the most valuable things I owned were my BMX bike and
skateboard,
my skateboard. Yeah. And then like whatever boombox I had,
sure.
You know, like whatever you played music on. Those were the most valuable things that like you owned. And then eventually I got a guitar. And like kids these days have like all kinds of super valuable tech, you know? And so anyway, all I'm trying to say is like kids don't want to be a part of experience. You know, so if you give them something to be a part of experience yeah. with, like they still value it. I mean, how many of them are actually putting that cassette into a cassette player and listening to it, I guess is anybody's guess, but it makes me realize like, yeah, like they still value it. The world's changed. We now stream music a lot more than we listen to it physically, but we still want a connection to like the experience of music as an art form.
Tim, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. It has been a genuine pleasure. Anytime you want to take the 3-hour trip down from the Chicago area to Springfield, we'd love to see you here in the gallery to see the show. You can hang out here in the studio and we'd love to host you here if you have the opportunity. I know that you'd rather be in your tour bus going to some exotic locale, but if you find yourself in Central Illinois, you know you're welcome here to see the show.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think that Chicago, Illinois, they need to see all the music that comes out of here and how it affects the whole planet. So I definitely want to check it out. So I'll take you up on it sometime.
Thanks for listening to the State of Sound podcast. For more information about the podcast or the exhibit, please visit musicfromillinois.com.
We are the nowhere generation. We are the kids that no one wants. We are a credible threat to the rules you set.
Sure. Welcome to the wrap-up show for the State of Sound podcast. We've just finished our interview with Tim McElrath from Rise Against with Exhibits Director Lance Tozer. I'm joined by Jake and Lance, and we reconvene to kind of conclude this episode.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this, guys. This was a pure pleasure for me. I had taken upon myself in the role of developing the exhibit for some of these artists that were in the Chicago area to make arrangements to pick up the artifacts directly. I picked a bad week. It was a snowy, big snow. I mean, I barely got there, and I'm driving a big white van in the city of Chicago. Bad move, not smart. Tim was another one of these artists that, from a standpoint of being accessible, was a byproduct of the COVID situation. If it had been a normal year, he would have been on tour somewhere, and I probably would not have had the access to him that we got. And so he was at his studio in Arlington Heights, which I love. He didn't really go into it too deeply, but it's a really cool nondescript big building that was once a dental lab. They made dentures there, and he turned it into this really cool studio and hangout space. And but one of the things that really struck me about him is that he's one of these guys that not only he talks the talk, but he walked the walk. He has been straight edge vegan since he was a kid, and he like he mentioned, he really developed into his views. And I think, you know, to be perfectly honest, some people coming through our exhibit are going to look at some of these artifacts and go, what in the world is that? His artifact isn't necessarily controversial as an instrument, but he does have a sticker on the side that we didn't even talk about that says, tape a cop. Which is essentially that this, you know, this mindset of holding police accountable. And it sounds weird when I say tape a cop, but I mean, that's kind of what the sticker was.
Right. And I was aware of the political aspect of Rise Against and McElrath. And so with that in my mind, I didn't expect him to be as laid back and sort of cool as he was. Maybe not cool isn't the right word, but he seems like an interesting guy. And and he was completely right. And I'm glad you brought this up during the interview. He's completely right that I don't even remember how Corey Crawford got injured during that Blackhawks run. People don't ask questions as long as the Blackhawks win.
You go to a punk show, that's what happens.
You hurt your foot. Yeah, they were really mad at first. And I love the side story about Scott Darling getting a chance to play. He's a guy from like Naperville or something. I can't remember where Scott Darling, Bolingbrook. Anyway, yes. He's from a Chicago suburb, local kid. He's Corey Crawford's backup, and he gets a chance to play and then gets a big contract after the year. And then they accidentally meet up at a Cubs game. That's brilliant. I mean, you can't write that, you know. So the other thing I wanted to mention was I was prepared for him to be intense personally when I met him, and he was not. He was extremely warm. He gave me his cell phone number. He does have that ocular thing with one green eye and one blue eye that's a little disarming.
Cool.
The same thing David Bowie has. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to even try to pronounce the technical term for it. So that's a little disarming, a little strange. He was wearing a mask. I was wearing a mask, but you could see those two different eyes.
I didn't realize there was that Bowie connection there. But yeah, definitely intense was what I was going for. Yeah. And not that you wouldn't be cool, but
sure, but
much more intense.
When your music is like, you know, political and, you know, you talk about issues and things like that, and you know that the artist is involved and very socially conscious and all of that, there is this, you know, assumption that the person might be a little intense, might be a little very, you know, super serious, but it's just a very warm and genuine. And honestly, it sounds like a guy you'd run into at a show.
Yeah. No, I was totally prepared. I was had a little anxiety. I was meeting a lot of these people all at once. I had anxiety about driving in the snow. I wanted to make sure I was representing the museum properly. I wanted to come across as a professional. At some point, there's no way that I can match his coolness level. So I just need to kind of be straight ahead, be honest with him, be thankful for his involvement. And I think, you know, his story is a really great story from a standpoint of why we did this exhibit. Here's a guy who came from the suburbs of Chicago, had no intentions of becoming a global superstar. And I don't think people really realize how big they are. They're huge all over the world. And but I loved the story about him taking the train into the city, going to record stores and finding out about parties and shows and becoming a part of this underground culture that probably just doesn't exist in the same way because of the internet now, but I think there's something special about that. And I don't know if it's necessarily unique to Chicago or to Illinois, but I think that's his story. That's his Illinois music story.
And the importance of the all ages shows too, that he could get in without being 21. And I had a question about the item in the exhibit, the guitar. Now, was that something that, did he give us an option? Like, how's the sausage made? Did he give us the option of what items we wanted, or did he say, this is what you want?
No, so great question. Thank you, Jake. So for each scenario, when I got to that point where I finally got to speak to the actual artist, so usually you have to get through managers. And so Tim has a manager, very nice guy named Graham, who finally realized that I wasn't nuts and that this was a real request and that it might be good for him to participate. And so you have to get through that layer. And so when you finally get it on an email chain with Tim, he said, well, let's just hop on the phone and let's talk about it so I can get an idea of what you're looking for and then I can think about it. And so so I got on the phone with him and I just said, you know, I don't want to project. I don't want to say, I really would like to borrow this. I would like you to say, people are going to come through and a lot of people are going to learn about Rise Against for the first time. What sort of singular object do you think helps tell your story? Something identifiable, something that was important. He said, well, I do have this guitar that's out of commission now, but it's important to me because we had gotten to the point where people started offering us free stuff. And Gibson had said, would you guys like a guitar? And he's like, well, yes, I play them already and I'd love to not have to pay for them. And so this was a big milestone for him as an artist where he wasn't just a guy. It's not a hobby anymore. A big company like Gibson is going to give him a, you know, $2,000 guitar or whatever those cost. They're not cheap. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big milestone for him. And, you know, he talks a little bit about the songs that he wrote on it and the tours that he went on. And I love the story about stopping at a truck stop at 3 o'clock in the morning and putting stickers on the back and paying tribute to a band that was important to him. And so all of those stories, I just said, stop, that's beautiful. I want it. That's great. Let's just do it. And he goes, all right, cool. It's in my studio. And we set up the time to pick it up. And so I'd love to say that all of them are like that. the artifacts. Some of them we're dealing with family members, and some of them we're dealing with people that are super busy, and they're just saying, I will offer you this, and I don't know how much thought went into it. There wasn't as much back and forth, but Tim was a classic example of what it was supposed to be like.
But, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say in the car, the guitar is so great because it's so representative of that point where he's getting to the place where he's starting to get free instruments, and it's like, of course I'll take a guitar. Like, no, I have enough. I'm fine. Like, no one's ever going to say that. But, you know, you get to that point where you're getting popular, things are really getting successful, but like you're still holding on to yourself. You know, you still put stickers on your guitar. You still, you know, play it as hard as you can, as fast as you can, as often as you can. So, you know, that's, you know, getting to that place, getting popular while still being true to yourself and remembering
punk rock credibility. It still broke the headstock off, you know.
It happens, yeah.
and the sticker almost gives its strings back to that upbringing, right? Of how he's listening as a young kid and getting the punk rock scene. And I wanted to mention, not all of the items have stories like that, but a lot of the items in this exhibit are story-driven. As we're recording this, we're on the verge of opening. Mm. And so I've been through, and a lot of these objects are really story-rich.
Yeah, and that was purpose. It was all about the approach, and it was one of the reasons why I personally went to Chicago in many instances. Some of them I just physically couldn't go to. I mean, Dan Fogelberg's guitar came from Maine, an island in Maine where his widow lives now. And she had to drive 3 hours to get it to a place where it could be shipped to us. So when we start talking about Dan Fogelberg, that there's a whole story about that too. So many of these artifacts in this show have wonderful stories, and we've created a gallery guide that have those backstories on there in many cases, or talk a little bit, that frame the artist's story a little bit better. And that was the reason why we did that, because you can only do so much in a gallery when you have 50 words or however many words we put on the artifact labels.
It never seems like enough.
Well, Jake proofed all of them. So, you know, he knows, you know, enough to be dangerous there with that, don't you? But, I think that's, you know, a part of the juice of doing a show like this about, you know, especially anything to do with pop culture, anything to do with things that have people have, you know, sort of they're stakeholders themselves as listeners, as fans, as whatever. So we're, you know, I think what I really hope people will get out of this exhibit is that they won't just stand in front of an artifact. They'll realize there's a story behind it, and it will in some ways humanize these people, that they're not just mythological, you know, stars. They are humans that you know, that use these instruments to enrich our culture, and hopefully there'll be that strong connection. Yeah. Great. Thanks for doing this, guys.
I enjoyed the interview, and I'm looking forward to all the rest of them.
Absolutely. I can talk about music all day, so just anytime. Yeah.
This has been the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.